last hour, hearing from each of our affirmative and negative sides. And as we move now into our second hour, we're going to give each side an opportunity to either restate their case and or present some new material. We'll have two short talks, one from affirmative, one from negative, and then one from affirmative, one from the negative. And then we're going to ask each side to pose a question to the other side, which they will then try and answer. At that point, if the panelists have run out of things to say, or the answers are insufficient, we're going to throw it open to you guys, and we've got a wireless mic here, and the panelists will, each side will take questions from the floor on the topic of whether or not the resurrection is myth or reality. So I want to invite one of the speakers from the affirmative to come, and we're going to go 5 minutes, so one bell at 4 minutes, two at 4:30, and the continuous ringing at 5 minutes to state your case or resolve.
One of the reasons that we are standing up here now to even have a debate about whether the resurrection of Jesus physically happened is because all of us are confronted with a whole number of documents that claim to be a reliable account of what happened 2,000 years ago. I say a number of documents, it's very easy to say that the New Testament was all kind of a one book, but it's many, many different sources written by different people, but all are claiming that about 2,000 years ago, Jesus of Nazareth, the one who was killed under Pontius Pilate, was physically raised from the dead. And I think our big question we want to ask is, can we trust what we read in these documents? There are two separate questions. I'm only going to deal with one of them. One question is, can you be sure that what you read is what was written? That's one question. That is a different question from this. How can we be sure that what was written actually happened? Now, the first question is all about transmission. That is, through the centuries, were the words that were originally written down accurately passed on? Now, that is a different question from the question that says, what was written down, did those events actually happen? Now, I want to deal with the second question. We could get into discussion about the accuracy of the transmission. And I think you guys can be fairly confident, really confident, that the things that you read now in the New Testament were what were written down. Do we have the original manuscripts? No. But we have such a weight of evidence, such a number of manuscripts over time, that we can be accurately assured that what we are reading now is what was written down. The question I want to focus is really, how can we be sure that what was written down actually happened? In a court of law, you are presumed to be innocent until you are proven guilty. It seems that in our culture, the cultural air that we breathe for the Bible is that it is assumed to be false and made up until proven otherwise. But let me give you a few reasons that cumulatively together persuade me that the New Testament records are reliable. First of all, the claim and the style of the documents themselves. I don't know if you have ever, as an adult, read a New Testament document. If you have not, then that would be my first thing I would say today. Go and grab one, read it through. What do you see about their claims and their style? Well, they do not read as myth. They read as books supposedly happening in real history. They want to be taken seriously as history. They're not written as myth. They speak about real times and real people and real places. And when they do, again and again, the New Testament is shown to get it right. I love their honesty. I really do. You read through the New Testament documents, you read about the disciples, they just show themselves for who they are. They don't try and cover up. There are many occasions when they just seem to be portrayed as stupid, not getting things right. If you were making this up, I just don't think you would do that. They just seem to write as it happened. Even when Jesus talks about the resurrection, he predicts his resurrection from the dead before it happened. And you don't read that the disciples said, wow, we're looking forward to this. They go, we don't get it. And that is because in the Jewish background of the day, they were not expecting someone to be physically raised from the dead ahead of the end of history. It was just completely bonkers to them. And so therefore, the whole physical resurrection of a man before the end of history was not something everyone was expecting. So we've got to explain, how did that view arise. And even how the disciples reacted after the physical resurrection appearances. There are many accounts of just the disciples just not believing, not getting it. Again and again, there is a real honesty from the sources themselves. Eyewitness detail, you can see this traced through. Ian already mentioned before the testimony of the women. The fact that this stuff is not neat, but when you do a bit of digging, it's not contradictory. The things all fit together. I would like to say to you that all this stuff is historical, not story. It's not just that people kind of thought these are some nice mythical stories. The things that are being claimed had footprints in history. They had an impact in history, and we've got to make sure that we know why the footprints were made. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I'll call on a speaker from the negative.
Yes, so Itzi asked me to be the first speaker because apparently I'm better prepared than he is. Lee mentioned again the documents, and he said something like, oh, this person said this, that person said that at this point. You mentioned that certain claims happened. The fact is, we only have documents that are from a fairly late stage, something like 40 years later. So we don't have Jesus telling his people, I will die in a few days. We have John telling something like 60 years later that Jesus, who he has never met, told people that he died before he foretold his death. So that's something they told something like 60 years later. That would be, if I would be the first person to tell you about Charlie Chaplin, I mean, that's a time span. That's a long time. If I'm the first person to tell you about Chamberlain, about the Second World War, that's a long time. So it's not something like that happened just here and it's an eyewitness account. It's a person who never met the person, had a very significant position within that community, telling something like years later what he thinks should have happened before. And we have evidence that people made up things that should have happened. They often say, this has happened so as to prove this prophecy. So they introduce, quite often, he wasn't brought up yet, so they introduce this person, Joseph of Arimathea. Nobody knows where Arimathea is. They don't agree on who he was, but it's quite clear that he was introduced because it would have been embarrassing if Jesus would have been put into a mass grave. He had to have a good grave. So there might have been a guy, but this guy appears something like 70, at about 70 BC. Just give me a second. So, but what I actually want to say is, these stories were meant to convey theology. So, and we see this all the time. People put words into Jesus' mouth or the disciples' mouth. I mean, you've seen this here. You said something like, they said, oh, they said you killed him. That's the gospel of Ian. If you would write the gospel, it would happen. And this happened the same at that time. And you don't want to treat them as the reality. Suppose somebody would be dead and he would be alive. If this would be really reality, you would like to see medical records. You are not here because you saw a medical record of some proof. You are here, if you're a Christian, because you like the story, because you like the sentiment. You like the sentiment of a person who says, oh, I will die for your sins. But if you think that it's actually real, I mean, do you really want to somebody who died for your parking tickets? I mean, if somebody would say, I killed this kitten for your parking tickets, that would be awful. I mean, if it's real, it's a nice sentiment. I mean, to say something like this, I would die for you. But, I mean, you don't mean this real. The same is if you say, oh, he felt the agony, and this can be fairly comforting for people who are in sick or close to death, to imagine even the Son of God had to go through this agony. But it's something different if you know he actually knew what would happen. Death is scary because we don't know. But he said something like, oh, listen, it's just an hour this afternoon, this evening, we will be up with my father having a blast. That's not, I mean, you want the comforting story, but if it's real, then this guy is just something like the son of the big guy who is pretending to be one of us. So you don't want to be it reality. If you want to be it reality, you need proof, evidence, documents. The earliest documents are from the second century that we have. The earliest papyrus that you mentioned is from 120, it's 14 words. It's not a book, it's about 100 years later. It's Google, it's P55 or something. If you talk reality, it's the evidence. If you want to have the nice, uplifting stories, you have to live with the fact that it's mostly myth. It's a good story, maybe, but if you ask for evidence, you are ruining the joke, kind of. It's like explaining a joke, and you don't want to do this. And you should leave this to us atheists to be annoying about evidence and stuff.
We'll give the affirmative side one chance to respond.
He's keen, isn't he? Thank you. Well, look, I became a Christian from a Hindu background, and the reason I became a Christian is because I was convinced that Jesus really did die, he stayed dead, and then he rose on the third day. And if that didn't happen, then I don't actually want to be a Christian. So it is important to us that it's real, that it's based on evidence. I just want to respond to Dr. John's really helpful three statements that he made. The first one was that the resurrection is physically impossible, and I guess that's the whole point. People in the ancient world knew that when someone died, they stayed dead. The fact that Jesus rose from the dead is evidence that God is transcending the normal ways that he sustains the universe, the normal operation of physical laws. And if he didn't do that, then we have no way of knowing that he's really there. So God is stepping into history, changing things to show us who he is. The fact that Jesus can turn water into wine, he can make the lame walk, and that he was physically resurrected from the dead, the whole point is that is not normal. And therefore that shows him to be something more than just human. The second point was that it's logically inconsistent. That the immortal God cannot die. And in one sense, Dr. John is almost quoting a famous hymn that we sing, you know, 'tis mystery all, the immortal dies. And I guess it depends on how you understand what Jesus, who Jesus was. See, Christians believe that God became human flesh. And this wasn't like Superman pretending to be Clark Kent. So he's just a kind of, you know, he just covers over the kind of S and the underpants that he wears when he's Superman. But he's just pretending to be human. And when Clark Kent gets hit by a taxi, the taxi gets destroyed. No, Jesus really did become a human being. And he really was able to suffer when they pierced him on the cross, when they whipped him and beat him. He really felt that. And the mystery is that why would God deliberately choose to become a human being, live amongst us, and then physically die? But the mystery is that how is it possible that death could not hold him? That he was too powerful, that the Son of God, although physically dead, is not merely resuscitated, but somehow conquers death, and therefore is able to offer us hope of life beyond death. So it is only logically inconsistent if you assume you know what God is like before you've seen what Jesus is about. Christians believe that Jesus reveals to us what God is like, and therefore we measure God by what Jesus has shown us. And the third statement is, why did those stories circulate? Well, they circulated because they were true. Right from the beginning, we've made two statements, that the tomb of Jesus was empty, that they were not able to find the body. They weren't able to refute the stories of the resurrection of Jesus by bringing out a body, because he was not there. He was resurrected from the dead. And the second reason we've said that you ought to believe the resurrection is the transformation in those disciples. These were young Jewish boys. Some people think they were only just teenagers. And they'd just seen their master crucified. And the Bible says that actually they were locked away for fear. And then they met him, and then they were transformed. So Ansfar said that these things were written down a lot later. Well, those stories were circulating as oral history for a long time, it's true, before they were written. But they were circulated during the time when people were alive to be able to refute them. three of the disciples were eyewitnesses. John was an eyewitness. He's mentioned in the Gospels many times. Mark and Matthew were part of Jesus' followers. And Luke, it's very clear. It says, I was not an eyewitness, but I have interviewed all the people that saw these things. And therefore, this is what I am telling you. And again, you know, this idea that they were written later to support a church that existed by powerful people, I say that's undermined again by what they write about those disciples. Take Peter. Peter was the leader of the early church. And yet we are told that Jesus said to Peter, Peter, Satan is speaking through you, when Peter said that Jesus would not go to the cross. Now, if I was Peter, an important member of the church, this would not be a great CV, curriculum vitae moment, that the Son of God has called me Satan. Also, Peter denies Jesus on three occasions. So again, the idea that these were circulated later and concocted stories doesn't fit the facts that they were so blatantly honest about their own failings.
I'll call on Yitzi for a response.
You're too kind. Krish asks, somewhat rhetorically, why the story circulated, and answers his own question, that they circulated because they were true. To this he adds that a body was not found, so that this claim could not be falsified with the presence of a body. I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of how difficult it is to rob a grave. It doesn't take a miracle. It doesn't take God himself. It is not particularly difficult for a group of people to get a dead body out of a tomb. That's not the only explanation that, oh, it must have become a god and risen into heaven. The second thing to note is that the stories that were being told, the stories that spread, weren't being presented alongside evidence. That let's say all of us on stage saw someone rise from the dead and then decided to go through the streets of Sydney Union and tell people. It wouldn't make any difference how many people believed us, because the evidence that we were showing them was zero. So it would ultimately be a kind of test of how persuasive we were rather than how accurate we were. And I think here it's very important to distinguish between the mimetic value of an idea, how well it spreads, and the truth value of an idea, how right it is. That Muhammad could rise and proclaim what he did, and that by sword and by book, Islam could spread from the very eastern edges of Arabia, from almost Pakistan, through to the Straits of Gibraltar in the space of less than 100 years is incredibly remarkable. But it does not say anything about how true or false the Quran is. It does not say anything about whether the angel Gabriel really did show up and talk to Muhammad and tell him what to write. Krish also points out on the issue of the impossibility of the resurrection, that people knew, even then, that when someone died, they stayed dead. It's interesting that he has given me the very knife with which to stab this point in his first speech. The issue of the black swan is a very interesting one. If I see a swan, and I see another, and one more, and then I see 1,000 swans, and all of them are white, I can say that it seems to me as though all swans are white. The presence of a single black swan does disprove this. But it's important to understand that empirical evidence, the logic from induction, reasoning from induction, is always going to be limited. If I say that the sun will rise tomorrow, I'm saying this based on the fact that the sun has risen before. But much like the case of the swan, we don't know that this is going to be so. All of science, more so, all of everything we do all the time is based on the assumption that things will continue to happen as they have happened. It's a very weak assumption at its core, but it's a necessary one for us to live as humans. I assume that when I go home and I turn the door, that the door will open and let me in rather than transform into a dragon and eat me. I don't know this. I assume this. And the fundamental problem of inductive reasoning plays out here. Because let's say that everyone that we've ever seen die has stayed dead. and suddenly someone rises from the dead. This means, and all that it means, is that our previous understanding that people stay dead when they die was wrong. It does not mean that the man who did not stay dead was the God of the universe. It does not mean that this man was the physical incarnation of a being that is omnipotent, omniscient, and the creator of all things. It is not the God of Aquinas, Anselm, and Augustine that you are proving here. All you are proving, even if the resurrection happened, is that the resurrection happened. I think it's very important to understand that. And the understanding of what this all is about, the understanding that even if you come away from here saying the resurrection definitely, definitely happened, you still have your work cut out for you, is a very important one. And I invite all of you who are serious about this, to go and do more research and to find out, A, whether or not it did happen, because we're not going to be able to quote all the sources at you now. We don't have them with us. We couldn't have the time. And B, that what does it really mean if it did? Thank you all for joining us here today.
So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to ask the affirmative to pose a question, which we're then going to ask the negative to respond. And after that, the negative will have a chance to then ask a question of the affirmative. In terms of responses, I'm going to limit each side to between 2 and 3 minutes, just so that we can possibly have some questions from the floor.
Hi, is this where we're working? Muhammad Ali, when he was at the height of his powers and had become joined a form of Islam, was asked if he could be anywhere at any time in human history, where would he like to be and when? And his answer was puzzling, because he said, I would like to be outside the tomb of Jesus Christ on Easter Sunday morning to see what really happened, which is a great question. And I want to go back to the question that Lee has asked. We got a tiny bit of an answer, I think, from Yitzi then, or was it before that? What do you think if you were actually outside the tomb around about then happened? What we got the slight suggestion about the possibility of the disciples stealing the body. What do you do with this event, which is one of the great events in human history? What is your explanation for those events that we've been asking for from the beginning?
Okay. I stand anyway. Are there a few kids behind me? So you ask what happened anyway. That's a fair question. And what you do in these cases, we at a university, you look at the evidence. And the evidence we have are one account of Mark, and that's about it. And we've got later accounts who copied Mark and later accounts who kind of reinterpreted Mark. And the very first account of Mark says there was an empty tomb, there were two women, it was empty, and there was a guy saying, he's not here. So that's all we know. For everything else, you need more evidence. So that's a general rule. If somebody says something like, oh, there was something, even if Itzi says something like they maybe stole, we need evidence. But nobody has evidence. We don't have evidence, you don't have evidence. And if you don't believe me that I've got evidence for the fact that there's no evidence, go out and look for it. I mean, it's there that there is no evidence. That you might not know this, that, for example, the end of Mark, at the beginning, the only thing we know is that it ends with the empty tomb. Or the thing about resurrection, those endings are actually, the long ending was added later, probably, and the short ending might not be the actual ending either. So all we have are a little bit of tidbits. We've got an empty tomb. And you should ask yourself, if I see an empty grave, what's the most logical explanation? And you go by the evidence. And speculating is something that you might want to do, which is fun, and you might speculate a lot, but speculation doesn't get you closer to the truth, it just gives you maybe a good story. That feels right, but without evidence, and we are talking about reality, without evidence, this is all just, you shouldn't pretend to know something if you don't have evidence, even if it feels good.
You'd like a right of reply?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have one or two friends who don't believe in evolution from simple to complex life. And if every time I want to show them evidence, they simply say, there is no evidence, there is no evidence, there is no evidence, you can't know because there is no evidence, that feels like what's happening here. because when you there's a mountain of evidence which has persuaded all sorts of historians, and especially historians and lawyers, that when they look at the evidence, instead of just saying there is no evidence, I mean, your view of Mark's gospel and John's gospel is the very best of 19th century scholarship. I mean, it's nonsense to say that John's gospel was written well into the second century when the fragment that you mentioned, which no one takes to be the original, is from dated reliably at 129 AD. So you're saying it wasn't written till about sometime in the second century, yet we've got a copy of it, or a snippet of it, that is not the original, that is right on that date or before. So that to say that Mark's the only witness is just, in terms of history, nonsense. It was persuasive around about 1850, but scholarship has moved on since then, and Luke in particular, and it's actually Luke who records, not me, that line, "You killed him, God raised him, we saw him." That's not me, that's from Luke. Luke is often used in universities like this in Macquarie Uni as an extraordinarily reliable source of information about the first century. And so that you just seem to be saying somewhat cheaply, there's no evidence, there's no evidence, which is just like a creationist who says to me, there's no evidence revolution. And I think it just shows that you haven't actually bothered yourself to look at the evidence that has persuaded so many that the evidence is good, such as myself, but I'm not eminent, but there are many other eminent scholars I can, not many other, many eminent scholars I can mention who've been surprised by the evidence.
Okay, I'm going to be fair, I'm going to ask the negative to, you want to write a reply on this one or you want to ask a question?
I have a similar question.
Yeah, absolutely. So now it's the opportunity for the negative to pose a question to the affirmative, and John, I believe you're going to do that.
Well, there's a huge amount of evidence, I agree. All the dead people in the world who've never been resurrected, I take to be negative evidence against the resurrection. But my question, actually, to the opposing side is this. Surely you believe in Christianity, you're Christians, you have faith. So you want to believe in the resurrection. You have a strong motivation for believing in it. So do I. I'd love to believe in it. I'd love to be a dedicated Christian. I'd love to believe in Christianity, but I can't. I think it's internally inconsistent, and all the evidence from science and evidence from suffering in the world that I can see tell against it. So really this debate is between people on the right-hand side who actually do look at the evidence, who do look at science, who do look at all the other textual issues, and people on the left who want to believe. They want to believe, and that's why you guys on this side are not interested in looking at the kind of evidence that we have, but you have your faith to look at. That's my question.
Can we respond?
You happy to respond?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. Really, really good question. I guess I don't want to believe unless it's true. That's really important to us. In fact, we're going to be looking at the next few days that Paul said, look, if this isn't true, then Christians are to be pitied more than all people. There's no point believing it unless it's really real. And the idea that Christianity is just wish fulfillment, we really want it to be, and we're just kind of going to hope that it's true, even against all evidence, the argument could work the other way around. That the atheist, for example, might not want there to be a God because they don't like the idea of accountability to a higher power. So the idea that there are other motives at afoot doesn't confirm or deny the truthfulness of the Christian faith. And in fact, the idea that we are trying to talk about evidence in this public forum is saying that Christianity is not a blind leap of faith. It is trying to be informed by evidence. We're trying to expose our beliefs to public critique, to discussion and argument. So I think your last statement might have been unhelpful because it seems to be saying we're not really interested in the conversation, but we really are. And you're also raising the issue of suffering, and actually that's something we're going to be handling tomorrow, because the idea of resurrection is hope that there is a bigger answer to the problem of suffering. So come back tomorrow if you're available.
I gave the affirmative the right to respond. Do you want to respond
again?
That's
good. Yeah, sure. Some good points there. I think they're well taken.
Up and down like a jack in the box. I want to give you the audience an opportunity to ask questions. And the way we're going to do this is there's a wireless mic down here, which Richard, my trusty assistant Richard, is going to grab the mic. If you've got a question, can I suggest you raise your hand so he can see you? And there's one down there in the middle. And if you can state your question clearly, and you can either direct it to a particular member of one of the sides or generally to the affirmative or to the negative.
This is for the members of the negative side who believe that the tomb was robbed. And this might have been talked about in the first hour. I wasn't here for that. But if the tomb was robbed, what happened to the Roman soldiers who were posted outside the tomb?
This was covered in the first hour.
No. At this point, I'm going to step in and moderate and say, I don't think it was, and I'm going to demand an answer from the negative.
Insubordination, dereliction of duty, sleeping on guard? I have no idea, to be honest.
Paddy, can I?
The point is not that we know what happened to the Romans who are guarding the tomb, if there were Romans guarding the tomb. The point is that there are many things that could have happened to the Romans guarding the tomb, and the fact that the body was missing doesn't mean that he must have risen from the dead, because Roman soldiers who guard tombs are impossible to take out or deceive or bluff in any or corrupt in any way.
Yeah, I just want to say something, because in the first hour, we didn't mention the guards. There were two things that we did mention. We mentioned the empty tomb, and we mentioned the transformation of the close followers of Jesus. Now, I just don't think that those two things have been dealt with together. I think it is easy to pick them off one by one, to say, if we simply said there's an empty tomb, well, I'll give you loads of reasons what could have happened, but that's not what we're saying. We're trying to say you've got to deal with both those things together. So if you say someone nicked a body, that isn't good enough, because then you've got to have an explanation for why simultaneously the close followers of Jesus were transformed from cowards to courageous preachers. And I really would love not just some vague answers, but what do you think happened?
Okay, at that point, I want to be fair to the audience, because we've got another question down the front, and if we've got time, we'll come back to it. There was one down here, I think, was there? Yep, question.
Hi. I was wondering, with all this talk of evidence and no evidence being thrown around, for the Christian side, what would be the evidence from outside the Bible for the reality of the resurrection?
Thank you for your question. Can I try and limit you guys to a couple of minutes? Because I know that you may say there's mountains and mountains of evidence, and we don't have a couple of days. So just briefly, if I can limit you, just to be fair.
Just to make sure I've understood, you're saying, what is the evidence from non-Christian sources that Jesus rose from the dead? That's a good question. And I would think off the top of my head, there is no evidence that Jesus rose from the dead outside. There is massive evidence that shows the foolishness of Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and Michael Onfray's attempt to say that it didn't exist. That's beyond any scholarly question at all. I think the problem that happens is that when people seem to get convinced, they became Christians. So the Apostle Paul was one who was unpersuaded and thought the early Christians were blasphemous. When he got persuaded, he suddenly, his evidence is somehow or other not significant, because now he's a Christian. Or the brothers of Jesus, James. The brothers of Jesus mocked Jesus in John 6, and what seems to have persuaded them to have become Christians, according to the accounts, are they met Jesus. So the problem is, people who were convinced that he rose from the dead became Christians. So that you tend not to have writings from non-Christians saying, yes, it's true. You do have writings saying the Christians believed it and that they died for it, and it was difficult to put them down. And we do know that the earliest Jewish answer, the Jewish authorities' answer, because all of first Christians were Jews, obviously, Jesus and the boys, was that the disciples stole the body. That's the first attempt to explain that unshakable fact that the body was missing. And but you don't have non-Christian sources saying, because they tend to change. In the same way as you don't have evolutionists arguing good points of view for the creationists, because once you get convinced of A, you no longer argue for A, or you no longer argue for B. So that's why you don't have any evidence from non-Christians saying, hey, yeah, he rose from the dead. Although I've got one I'm going to mention, the last thing, from a very famous historian of the 20th century who became convinced but didn't become a Christian.
Question is, what about plausibility?
Can you explain that a bit more?
You don't have to be fully convinced, you just have to find some plausibility in it.
what we have from ancient history is the lucky survivors from records. That some non-Christians may have found it plausible, I have no idea. We simply don't have a record of that. What we have is the account of this peculiar movement with an absolutely novel doctrine, unparalleled, that someone, a real-time person who you could touch and feel, rose from the dead. It's not Jewish. It's not pagan. You can't blame it on the Christians because they sort of started it. And it seems to be an attempt for them to make sense of this guy who got slaughtered, troubled everyone by coming back.
Do you want to respond to that, or should I ask another question?
I can respond briefly.
Yeah, just a very brief response.
I mean, essentially, I simply agree. I mean, we have evidence that people were convinced at the time. We've got evidence that there are Christians around. I mean, there are Christians here. So, and people who are convinced of it, or get convinced or persuaded, become Christians. I mean, that's the evidence that we have got from historical scholars. There are some people who say there are Christians out there. They have got a rabbi that they believe in. But that's about it, and I mean, that's probably true. And one thing I want to add, maybe to give it a bit of an edge, you should treat these young Christians just like you treat any other new group that has fantastic claims. I mean, we see this happening all the time. Itzi mentioned one at the beginning. There are many out there. Just if somebody has a fantastic claim, even if I've got a claim, just go out and check it. I mean, just because something is a fantastic claim doesn't make it truer. It makes it should make you go and look out and do your homework.
Amen.
Okay, I want to draw it to a close. I know there must be lots of other questions, but I think it is time to stop, and by all means we can continue the discussion. Some of our panellists can stay around for a little bit. And just before I reintroduce Hugh, who's the EU president, can I please encourage you to thank both sides of our debaters, the affirmative and the negative.
You'll have to walk among the commoners.
Well, thanks very much, Paddy. And thank you for coming along today. We really appreciate taking the time to engage with these big questions. And I hope that this has been a helpful couple of hours for you. I study history, and I certainly know this has been a really stimulating time for me. We're going to be back on the front lawns tomorrow, 12 till 2, looking again at the resurrection and unpacking some more of the implications for this fantastical claim that Jesus really did rise from the dead. So if you're free tomorrow, 12 till 2, if you didn't get food poisoning from the barbecue, we'd love to see you back on the front lawns for another This Is Life event. Just so you know as well, the EU, which is a group of about 700 Christian students on campus, we have regular activities which are resuming next week. We've actually changed our whole program around to keep the conversation going. So if you've got more questions about Jesus, about life and death, and about any of the topics that we've raised in the last couple of weeks, can I encourage you to come along next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, all at 1 p.m. Yep.
10 cents.
Do you want all at 1 p.m. to find out more about Jesus and more about the claims that he makes. Thanks again very much for coming. If you can pop your feedback slip in the green buckets that are going around, that'd be a great way to ask questions and let us know you were here today. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow at 12 o'clock for another This Is Life event. Thanks very much.